From WABE in Atlanta, this is City Lights. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thanks for joining us. This is our daily look at the cultural life of Atlanta and the artists and organizations that make it happen. We have tragedy and comedy crossing the city's various stages. Dad's Garage is putting the short, furry Ewoks front and center in their original musical production of Wicket. We'll take a last look at Aurora and Theatrical Outfit's production of The Hunchback of Notre Dame. And the new scripted show at Dad's Garage is a take on Star Wars from a shorter, furrier perspective. It's called Wicket. That's with a T, and takes its name as a spoof on Wicked with a D. To sort out these multiple parodies, our producer Gabby Watt spoke with actor and singer Jamie Olilaw and the show's writer, Travis Sharp.
So Wicked has hardly anything to do with the actual Broadway smash Wicked. What is their connection?
Well, I'd say that Wicked, I'm going to really enunciate to make clear, Wicked is a parody show. It mostly parodies Return of the Jedi and all the Star Wars movies. In a much smaller way, it parodies Wicked the musical, in that in the same way that Wicked takes a well-known thing, which is Wizard of Oz, and reimagines it and shows us that there is a whole other side of it that you never knew about. So that is what this show does for Star Wars. We show that there is a whole other side of it that you never thought was there. And if you are a fan of Wicked, you will notice a few funny little moments that are pulled from that show. But I would say that the majority of the parody comes from Star Wars.
And I understand it's a revisionist history of Star Wars from the perspective of an Ewok. Of course, most people are Star Wars fans, so I'm sorry that this question is going to sound redundant and you're going to be like, oh, scoff, scoff for this question. But who are the Ewoks in Star Wars? And what is unique about your Ewok star, Wicket? Or is he just sort of your run-of-the-mill Ewok?
So depending on if you're talking from within the Star Wars films, and I'll start there. Within the Star Wars films, the Ewoks are a random race of cuddly teddy bear creatures that happen to live on this moon that happens to be the shield base for the second Death Star that the Empire is going to use to rule the galaxy. So that's sort of the Star Wars version of it, that they just happen to be there on this moon, they just happen to team up with the good guys, and they just happen to help the rebellion win the day. And if these cuddly little fabric softener bears hadn't been on this planet, the whole thing would have gone to pot and the bad guys would have won. Now, sort of from the bigger sense, the Ewoks are also a much maligned group of characters that a lot of Star Wars fans, particularly of my generation, really didn't like, because it kind of made these cool action movies feel like a little kid thing. And a lot of people said they just put them in there to sell toys. I can't answer the question of whether or not that's true, but they sure did sell a lot of toys, and Star Wars over the years has been called, it's a toy franchise that happens to make movies.
But actually that toy motif, I understand, plays into this production.
Oh yeah, well it definitely does. I mean, we as Ewoks are definitely super cute and cuddly, but the set design I think is really cool because there's a lot of influence from like Legos, and so you see this kind of toy fun. You know, our lightsabers and things of that nature are very much toy-like, and they're not trying to be these realistic displays of what you would see in the movies, but it's almost like even a parody in that. Like, these are toys. These are toy sets. These are toy bears. These are toy guns and lightsabers and all of the props and stuff that we use. So it's pretty cool.
And Gabby, to your point, sort of as far as the story goes, and I will, because this is very important in the nerd culture world, I'm going to say spoiler alert. So I'm going to spoil a few things in the show. One of the things we discover, one of these things we never knew about the Ewoks, is that they aren't just this accidental race of creatures that happen to live on Endor. They are actually there for a purpose and for a reason. They are an engineered race that was created by someone in our story, and they were created to be sold throughout the galaxy as toys. So this is actually a pretty major plot point in the show. And it's also part of the parody, too, kind of questioning this idea that, you know, is Star Wars art? Were these movies made to tell great stories? Or were they there to sell toys? There's been a lot of conversation on both sides of that. So that is something that we're kind of tackling in the show.
And do the actors have to crawl around on their knees to be the same height as an Ewok?
Not exactly. I mean, there are a couple of us who are almost life-size Ewoks, but the rest of us, we just suspend reality a little bit for that part of it. But now, so we're not crawling around per se to be Ewok size, but I think, you know, with our costumes and our manner, I think the audience will get it.
Yeah, one of the things, we tackle a few isms in this show, and I don't think the casual person that comes to see it is going to think about this too deeply, but we tackle sexism and racism and sizism in this show, and the sizism part kind of comes from this idea that little bitty Ewoks are these harmless little things, and of course they're cute and harmless, and they couldn't really contribute to some greater cause, which they actually do. So, and I think for me that also applies to casting. Like, I just want to cast talented people in a show, and you know, worrying too much about how tall they are. So, we have some tall Ewoks, we have some short stormtroopers, and that's just how it is. So, if you are looking for size accurate Ewoks, stormtroopers, emperors, and imperial officers, you might need to go see another Star Wars parody, because
there's just so many of them.
Yeah, I mean, you've got a lot to choose from. I would go to StarWarsParodies.org to pick another one. There's a lot of great options out there.
You're really selling it. You're doing a really good job of selling it.
I'm the worst marketer of a show of all time.
And Jamie, are you the scientist in the Empire?
I am. I am the mysterious ensign, a science officer of the Empire. So
I know she's tackling some of these sexisms.
Oh,
and
yeah,
sexism
and racism, you know. My character actually doesn't exist in any of the films, which is in and of itself a commentary. She is a woman, and she is Black, and she is in the Empire. So we get to see her challenges having to navigate this world where she is smarter than everybody, but is constantly being silenced, like literally being silenced and shut down until she just cannot take it anymore.
What Jamie might not tell you is she has possibly one of the greatest voices in Atlanta, maybe the country, possibly the world.
Let's just take it to universe, too.
Okay, galaxy. We use the word galaxy a lot.
We can do that.
And the galaxy is far, far away and close by.
And it's almost unfair to the production and to the audience, but every time Jamie's character goes to sing, a white male comes and cuts her off. Until the very, very end of the show, practically, where after being stopped time and time again, her character finally gets to deliver that 11 o'clock number that I think is going to bring the house down. And we're actually going to share that with you guys in a little bit. I'm super excited. Microphones can handle it.
That's true. We're all a little bit nervous. But I guess mentioning the music, of course, that's another similarity to Wicked. And I understand you've coined the genre Ewok rock. What is that?
Yeah, so Ewok rock is not the only genre within the musical, but Ewok rock, we do know a little bit about Ewok music because we do hear some performances from the Ewoks, particularly at the end of Return of the Jedi and their big celebration. And what we know about it is it tends to be a lot of primitive instruments, hide drums and little wooden xylophones and stuff like that. So they have this kind of like this primitive percussive sound. And but when they really turn it on, and we never really got to see this in the movies, is there's like definitely an element of sort of some hardcore hip hop laid on top of that. And that's really where Ewok rock happens. And it's when we realize in this show that the Ewoks were much, much more than meets the eye, that there is a much bigger story to their presence. And we start to learn that through their musical numbers.
And before we do the song, I have sort of going back to the theme of revisionist history and parodies, in Wicked, it exposes some of the more sinister sides of Oz, including the more sinister sides of the heroes that you usually expect to be the heroes. And Star Wars is also very black and white in terms of who is good and who is evil. Is there any point in this production or point of this production where you're also trying to expose the faults within the people that you traditionally think of as heroes?
Yeah, absolutely. And even within, we're kind of showing a different side of heroism amongst the heroes and a different side of villainy amongst the villains. We are going to learn that amongst these harmless, cute Ewoks, there are bad guys and there are good guys. We're going to learn that Princess Leia has a completely other side to her that maybe isn't so perfect and pearly and chaste as we thought it was. A lot of Star Wars fans will know the fairly random fact that Princess Leia, of every character in the Star Wars movies, is the most deadly aim. When she shoots her blaster, she usually kills someone. So that to me meant something, like, what's going on? And if you think about everything that Princess Leia has gone through, I mean, her parents left her. She was adopted by this dude. She became a senator. She became a princess. The world that she was sort of set to protect got blown up by the bad guys because she couldn't convince them otherwise. And so she's just got a lot on her chest. And we find out in the show that she has a whole other side, not necessarily a evil side, but she is flawed. And we see a side of her that we never saw before. And then even amongst the bad guys, Jamie's character, the ensign, is a bad guy. And she's really good at it. She's super smart and very ruthless. And if people would just listen to her, the Empire would win. But nobody's listening to her. So I think we kind of are finding some bad in the good, some good in the bad, and a lot of gray area that we never saw in the black and white stories of Star Wars.
Anyway, so we have a song. And could you first situate what we're about to hear?
So, as we mentioned, the ensign has spent however long in the Empire. And though she is the smartest, clearly, she is constantly being silenced and has gotten to this point where she can take it no more. And she just has to let it out. And so in this song, in this aria, the ensign explains to us what it's like to be her in this Empire, having to, even just to get in the door, she's had to really play small just to even be considered. And she's got to navigate that, even her ascension. You know, if she says in the song, if I burn brightly, I'll be fired. You know, so she's trying to navigate this world where these men are running things, these incompetent men who refuse to listen, and she's just had enough. So she's about to let you hear everything. And this is, I think it's really great that it has been written as an operatic aria because, you know, in the different genres of music, you know, opera is this genre to where you don't use microphones. It's all about the power of the human voice. And so that it's so significant that she's been silenced and suppressed for all of this time to where she finally lets it out. She lets it all out.
I'm so good at being bad, better than the Empire, yet no command, virtuous at being evil, so far ahead, I'm in the sequel, yet I'm dark side. I start started low, so I'd get tired. Now if I burn brightly, I'll be fired, and you can't see your blind eye limitation.
Thank you so much for singing for us, and thank you so much for telling us about Wicket. For anyone who goes, it should be the evening of a lifetime, it sounds. So thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
We just heard from actor and singer Jamie Alilaw and Travis Sharp, the playwright and mastermind behind the new scripted show Wicket at Dad's Garage. Wicket opens this Friday and runs every Thursday to Saturday through October 7th.
Support for WABE comes from Comcast Business. Comcast is committed to providing dependable internet service for businesses who depend on it. Comcast Business, internet, voice, and TV, built for business. And from Northside Hospital, offering clinical excellence across a full range of medical specialties, leading-edge technologies and treatments, and the personalized, compassionate care that you expect from Northside. Information at northside.com.
This is City Lights on WABE, where ATL meets NPR. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thanks for listening. Aurora Theater and Theatrical Outfit have done it again. The theater companies are co-producing a musical, The Hunchback of Notre Dame. When the show first opened at Aurora Theater in July, I spoke with director Justin Anderson, alongside actor David DeVries, who plays Claude Frollo. I asked if this particular production of The Hunchback of Notre Dame is an adaptation of the Disney movie or of the Victor Hugo novel. Here's Justin.
It's both. What the writers did was go back to the film and lift basically the entire score from the film by Alan Menken and Stephen Schwartz. And then they wrote about a dozen new pieces in a variety of iterations for this new stage adaptation. And Peter Parnell was brought on to adapt the libretto from the original novel by Victor Hugo. So they didn't adapt it from the screenplay, which had been adapted from the novel. Mm-hmm. They started fresh with the conceit that the music would be the bridge between the Disney experience and this new theatrical adaptation.
And it debuted in Berlin, not Paris, which might have seemed more logical. Why Germany?
I honestly don't have a very clear answer as to why. I do think there certainly is a deep affinity for the material because of its European roots, in essence. To my knowledge, it's the only Disney theatrical property that's really sort of initially made a splash in Europe before ever having...
I had some colleagues that were in the Stuttgart production of Beauty and the Beast. And the Germans love big, epic musical theater.
And fairy tales are quite central to their folklore.
Yeah, and so when I was working on Beauty and the Beast in the early 2000s, our musical director, Michael Kosrin, was frequently flying back over to Berlin and working on this production, which was a huge hit in Berlin. It was a really big deal. So, I mean, the Germans love their big, epic theater, and this really, thematically and production-wise,
absolutely
kind of tapped into that.
Yeah, I was reading a little bit about it, and they even referred to it in Wagnerian terms with leitmotifs.
Very much so. It's driven by this idea of fire, to both illuminate, to purify, to potentially harm. So it's very much along those lines of this broad scope of really trying to get into the soul of the human experience.
Hmm. David, you played Jean-Claude Frollo, and one of his first acts, that of saving and raising the deformed child, Quasimodo, seems generous, but he takes on a much more sinister role soon enough. Claude Frollo has much more of a backstory and is far more important a character in this stage version than in the Disney movie. How does that contribute to your understanding of his character or the playgoers?
Well, he's a fascinating character to play, and I think that the opening number of the piece really kind of sets him up. And the Disney movie portrays him as a pretty two-dimensional villain, but I think that there's a lot more nuance and ambiguity in this particular take on the story, and so, you know, the challenge is to find the love and the complexity that this man is tortured by, morally, physically, spiritually. And, that's been the fun of it for me.
Quasimodo is deaf from ringing the bells of the cathedral, as if it wasn't enough that the poor kid is deformed. I was wondering, how do you portray this role sensitively?
Sure. I think Hayden Ryder, who plays Quasimodo, has really done a beautiful job of crafting a vocal impediment that I think feels authentic without any degree of insensitivity to any particular disability or community. And what's beautiful about, I think, the approach that we've taken is that when he's in a very dropped-in realistic circumstance with Frollo and others from the outside world, it's a bit more pronounced. It's a bit more of a true impediment.
Mm-hmm.
But then when he is in his own personal life, in his own inner world, where the gargoyles speak to him or he's ruminating on his own thoughts, there's this unleashed freedom in his voice and often in his body. And what I think is so beautifully portrayed is the wish to be able to emanate that in every circumstance, and the hope that that is really who I am inside, even though I might be perceived to a different eye or ear to have a particular disability or impediment. So to me, I think there's a beautiful contrast that honors the obstacles that he's dealing with in a very honest way without pushing it to any degree of untruthful behavior.
And at the beginning of the story, you can almost understand Frollo's rationale for isolating Quasimodo.
Yes, yes.
He's trying to protect him from the ridicule of the public. But is he trying to protect himself more?
Well, Justin and I have talked about how Frollo kind of sees Quasimodo as himself, as a part of himself, that part of himself that he loves and loathes, the part that he wishes to keep hidden. You know, it's the id of Frollo's character, and he very much wants to keep that hidden and protected. And of course, when Quasimodo becomes a young man and begins to seek his independence as any young man would or should, that's when the problems really begin. And his lack of ability to keep that hidden along with his own desires. And of course, Esmeralda is the catalyst to this kind of the events of the story. And it's interesting to think of it in terms of that metaphor. And in some ways, Quasimodo is the grand metaphor for that in society, which we don't want to deal with, we would like to keep hidden. But what's the true nature of Quasimodo? I mean, there's, as we find out in the story, there's tremendous love and honor and duty and conflict. And so that's what universalizes the particular story in such a beautiful way.
And also makes it feel contemporary. I mean, we're living in an age with greater awareness and a plea for more inclusivity of people who are different. If you're just joining us, this is City Lights on WABE. Our guests today are director Justin Anderson and actor David DeVries. We're talking about Aurora Theater and Theatrical Outfit's production of The Hunchback of Notre Dame. Many people are familiar with the Disney songs. What music has been added to this production? This is ambitious.
Yes, well, they, the writers used the framework of the score for the animated cartoon to serve as a launching pad to either unpack themes that were already presented or to find different iterations of thematic material that would help to present particular character struggles or motifs that would need to be, or serve rather, I think, as a narrative framework to help build the momentum of the story. And so you find some additions there. There's probably the most noticeable, the end credits of the cartoon have a tune that has no lyric, and it developed into the song called Someday, which is now in Act Two that Esmeralda sings after she's been captured. Spoiler alert, friends, by Frollo. And so it's probably one of the most beautiful additions and bridges from the original source material. Well, I don't want to say original source material, meaning the novel, but from the score in the film to this new stage adaptation. And then there are different, again, iterations of the Bells of Notre Dame that keep coming back as a theme. Frollo has this beautiful, almost lullaby song called Sanctuary that, of course, was in the original movie as well, but it comes back often when he's working to continue either to win over or endear or reconnect or reassert status with Quasimodo. And so it becomes a bit of their sort of love and instructional language in a way. Mm-hmm. Yes.
You referred to it as a lullaby.
A lullaby, yeah, very much so, because it has a power and a potency of its own. Yes, there is a tremendous amount of Latin in the show that you would hear sort of in the distance a bit in the cartoon, but they were not necessarily pronounced songs, and our entire cast is sort of carrying that weight, not only as actors in the role, but basically a congregational choir as well. So those songs have been brought a little bit more to the forefront to really help, I think, shape authenticity of the 15th century, but often it's commenting on the narration as well.
We have two clips we were able to gather from your rehearsal. The first with David as Frollo. Let's hear Hellfire.
Such a sweet song.
Such a beautiful voice, David.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah, and you've put in your share of song and dance with touring Broadway hits.
I have. It's been an unlikely circumstance, but yes, I found myself in several big musicals, and coincidentally, the two big musicals that I have done, you know, in major tours and things like that have been composed by Alan Menken, who wrote the score for Beauty and the Beast, and Stephen Schwartz, who wrote the score for Wicked, which I did for 3 years. So it's an interesting marriage of those two kind of titans of musical theater. So based on that alone, it's worth a listen because the music is extraordinary. And I have to say that, you know, the play has a very interesting series of endings, and but it works very cumulatively, and I find myself very emotionally kind of completed by the end of the story.
Yeah, I was hoping we could touch upon that in just the few minutes we have left. The Disney movie changed several plot lines from the book, and I don't know if you want to give away any spoilers, but this production has sexual assault and a whole lot more death.
Yes, yes.
Do you prefer one ending to the other?
Well, I think this is certainly more authentic to the human experience. There is nothing glorious, I think, about the way that these circumstances end. And yet there still is a kernel of hope that, again, I refer back to the song Someday, that our hope and prayers, humanity, is that we will figure out a way to get past our differences and work out this issue with the other and stop letting that become this cyclical, divisive, point of contention for century upon century upon century.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that Menken and Schwartz were putting this together right at the turn of the millennium.
Right,
they were working
right
in the late 90s and the early 2000s. And so there's very much, you can hear it in the score, in the lyrics. There's this kind of sense of the great wheel of time making a big turn here. And can we really reframe the way we interact with one another?
I first spoke with actor David DeVries and Aurora Theater Associate Artistic Director Justin Anderson. The Hunchback of Notre Dame is a co-production of Aurora Theater and Theatrical Outfit. It opens this Thursday at Theatrical Outfit, the Balzer Theater downtown, and closes September 17th.
Support for WABE comes from the Cheese Fest of Atlanta, an artisan food festival celebrating specialty cheese and food producers, September 23rd at the historic Fourth Ward Park, sponsored by Le Bon V and Murray's Cheese. Tickets at thecheesefest.com.
Salman Rushdie has set his novels all over the world. For his latest, he wanted to tell a story about his adopted home, the United States.
The subject of reinvention of the self is completely central. People come through Ellis Island and change their names. People move from the Midwest to the big city.
I'm Ari Shapiro. We talk with Salman Rushdie about his new book, The Golden House, on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Weekday afternoons from 4 to 6:30 on 90.1 WABE.
This is City Lights on WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. threads of time, tradition, and change in Indigenous American textiles is the current exhibition at the Carlos Museum on the Emory University campus. The exhibit is filled with textiles from the Andes, Guatemala, and Panama, from ancient to modern. I spoke with curator and Emory art history professor Rebecca Stone about the exhibit, along with the Carlos Museum's chief conservator, Renee Stein. We don't usually think of textiles as surviving for hundreds of years, but this exhibition has several pieces that are ancient. I understand we have the weather to thank for that in large part. So how did some of these ancient textiles come to survive?
Well, the ones that we have in the show that are ancient come from Peru, and they have the driest coastal desert in the world on the edge of Peru, on the Pacific. There are places that have never recorded a single drop of rainfall. But this is where the textiles were buried, usually with mummies, because mummification actually began in the Americas, not in Egypt, about 500 years before the Egyptians did artificial mummification technique. The people in northern Chile had already done a version of it. And so mummies have been around for millennia. The ones in Chile come from 5500 BC and later. So the people are dressed for the afterlife, and they take all their things with them. It's a funny thing. You can say you can't take it with you, but the Andeans felt that you could.
Why don't we know more about that? Why do we associate mummies with Egypt and therefore presume that that's where mummification began?
Well, there's a long prejudice, I think, against the Americas as a creative place. I think many people who live on the continent now came from somewhere else, and they see it as a secondary part of the world. Whereas, and even calling it the New World, that's what the Europeans, it was new to the Europeans, but it wasn't new. If we've had mummies for 7,000 years and we have a basket, a piece of an old basket, from 8,800 BC that was preserved in a dry cave in Peru. But our school system doesn't pay very much attention to it. And we need to address this ignorance. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to do this show for many years, was partly because people aren't even aware that these textiles from ancient times exist. And they just don't appreciate the native peoples of this continent as much as they really should.
How did the Carlos end up preserving them?
We have been given gifts of textiles. We have 700 textiles, and they were all given to us, partly because people knew that was a specialty of mine, and they want, and textiles are really, frankly, a hassle to keep yourself. You know, they fade. You don't really do them justice to keep them in your house. The humidity will hurt them. Light will hurt them. So many times people say, I'd like a museum to take these off our hands, in a way. I had so much to choose from for this show, which has almost 150 pieces in it. It's a large exhibition.
And because it's so large and we have so many textiles, the work for this project to prepare the objects actually extends back into even before we started this exhibition. When the gifts came to the museum, they were processed into the collection and then housed in order to make them accessible for the study and research and classes. And in that process, we treated the textiles that needed to be stabilized and identified the ones that were going to need more work to get them ready for display. So that's been a whole nother piece of getting the exhibition ready that has sort of its roots in our long-term efforts to preserve these objects.
I was going to ask you, Renee, how much of your work is conserving and how much is restoring?
That is probably answered on an object-by-object basis, but I can definitely say that the vast majority is conservation. As a current conservation professional, our goal is to preserve what comes to us from the past and conserve it for the future. We're not interested so much in restoring it to what it once was. But there is an element of restoration to some of the treatments that I undertake. For example, if I need to make an object whole again and the fragment that connects two parts is missing, and I can with confidence recreate what is missing, then I will restore that part in order to create the unity and the attachment that was missing between those two pieces. But it is never really my goal to restore something to its original appearance. It has a long life and it should look old, but not battered and unappreciated for that life.
When people hear textiles, they often think clothing, fabric that is made into clothing. What are some of the other uses of textiles seen in this exhibition?
Well, I would have to say the majority do have a clothing aspect. And we tend to separate out art from craft, and we tend to put textiles into craft. I don't subscribe to that dichotomy. I think you have to be very good at crafting in any art form. And I also see these indigenous women artists, these are made by women. We do have many other uses besides garments. We do have three textiles that are used by shamans, sacred textiles for holding the bundle of power objects that they use to cure people. We have one from the modern Maya, one from modern Bolivia, and one that's almost 1,000 years old from ancient Peru that was filled originally, and we still have its little miniature textiles that are inside the bundle. So these are very interesting because textiles to us are not so sacred unless maybe worn by the Pope or by a rabbi or something like that. But weaving has a sacred and cosmological significance because it's so elemental. The strings that are crossing each other form the four directions, for example, and they're orderly. Textiles are nothing if not orderly. You can't make a cloth if you're disorderly. It will unravel or it will be tangled. It won't be a real beautiful textile. So they embody order and cosmic knowledge in many ways. The other amazing use of textiles, and this is where the show begins, is as writing. Now, we define writing, we think it's usually when you make marks on a page or a papyrus or maybe scratch cuneiform, but the Inca and some people before them took strings and tied them together and put different knots in them, and that was their writing, and they're called quipu. And we have three of them, and there's about 800 left in the world, so we feel very privileged that we have three in our collection. They also posed a really interesting conservation and testing, scientific testing problem for us that I think Renee should discuss.
The three of them also present three different types of materials. So one of them is made from animal fiber that has been dyed, and so it was quite colorful, although those colors have faded over time. And then the second one is made of cotton, and so a plant fiber. And the third is a different plant fiber and much more unusual, and sort of presented us with the question of what is this material? It was not common to the rest of the fiber objects or textile objects in our collection until we started looking. And we actually undertook some examination and analysis to try to identify this fiber. This was actually the project of a Mellon Fellow who had come to our lab for 2 years to do research and treatment and as part of her professional development on her way to being a conservator. She had already gotten a graduate degree. And she spent that 2 years working on all sorts of projects in our collection and took this on quite wholeheartedly, tracked down researchers throughout the world, sent them samples. What is this stuff? And of course, we can only remove a few millimeters of a fiber for identification purposes. So you're very limited in what material you have. You don't want to send it to hundreds of folks because that's hundreds of millimeters. So you take one little sample, get really good pictures, send it to the right people, and ultimately get a plant identification, which turned out to be a Fricrea andina, so a native grass plant from South America. And then recognizing it in the case of this particular single strand from a quipu, we also found it to be evident on other objects in the collection, particularly some fans that have feathers on them. So then we were curious about when were these fibers used. So the same conservator took very small samples and sent them for stable isotope analysis at University of Georgia in Athens, and we got a carbon-14 date. And so we know that they are both ancient, not a modern use of a local fiber to recreate something from antiquity, but in fact an ancient object in a material that we were less familiar with, prior to this research. So those are included in the exhibition, and some of this technical research and notes appear as well in the online catalog that Rebecca has written and included some of this information.
So much science in this art.
Absolutely.
Yes, that's right.
If you are just joining us, this is City Lights on WABE, where ATL meets NPR, talking with Dr. Rebecca Stone of the art faculty at Emory University and Renee Stein, who is conservator at the Carlos Museum. We're discussing Threads of Time, Tradition and Change in Indigenous American Textiles, on view at the Carlos through December 17th. Throughout time, we see how people in the Andes, Guatemala, and Panama began incorporating Spanish imports into their work. Things like the guitars and horses and the Habsburg eagles. But thinking about the disease and violence that the Spaniards brought to Indigenous people in the New World. Were those elements reflected in the textiles? Is there any expression of the suffering of foreign infliction?
Well, I think there are political aspects. Certainly when they incorporated the Habsburg eagle, which is a double-headed eagle that had been used for many things, the Holy Roman Empire and others. And it just happened to be that the last two Spanish rulers were from the Habsburgs, Charles V and Philip III. But what's interesting is that the pieces, we have one that's from the Guna people of Panama, that's a blouse panel made by women, and we have one that's an altar cloth from the Maya from 1890. They both have this double-headed eagle. In the Guna, they have the idea of multiple-headed animals. Right next to it in the show, we have a six-headed snake that they put into one of their blouse panels. And multiple-headed animals are often seen in visions that shamans have. And the Guna are still shamanic in many ways in their religion. So this, when we see it and say it's the Habsburg eagle, it's an example of what an important theme in the show is syncretism, which means two schools of thought or religions that somehow overlap, so that it could mean the different things to different people. So the Spanish could say, oh, aren't they being nice little Spanish subjects by putting the Habsburg eagle? And the Guna could say, well, you all have a funny two-headed eagle, but to us it means something very different. It's a spirit that we see on the fourth level of the universe or something like that. So they can have two meanings. There can be subversive information, what you might call subversive, where it looks like a good Catholic situation, but underneath it there might be shamanic content. And I spoke of the sacred cloths. This is particularly important in the use of these shamanic cloths. I was reading a book written in 1940 about what the people in this town called Chichicastenango, which is a fun place to say, do, and the shaman will actually bring the sacred cloth full of the power objects into the Catholic Church during Mass and use it, making the sign of the cross, but the four-direction cross, not a more vertical Catholic cross, the north, south, east, west, on top of his patient's head in the middle of Mass.
Rebecca, how do some of the more recently made textiles reflect current styles and cultural moments?
The Guna are wonderful with this because they are very open to the world. They live in the country of Panama. The Panama Canal is where the entire world coalesces and goes through. And they are very topical in their imagery. We have one example that has the Panama Canal in it with a ship. But the sky is completely done in spiral geometric patterns, which they are call their grandmother patterns, the most ancient and most cosmological patterns. We have one that's the Madonna and Child, and the Madonna and Child are done in a lurid pink because we are the white people who look so pink. especially when we get sunburned and go to Central America. We have churches. We have the most wonderful one. We have the Trix cereal rabbit.
Oh, and I heard R2-D2 appears.
We have in modern Bolivia, we just purchased a piece made last year because the idea of the show is tradition and change and coming through time all the way to the present. And it has R2-D2 in it. He's sideways and he's in a bright, bright neon green.
Finally. Do you think the type of textiles made today could survive 1,000 years?
I think given the right environmental conditions and preservation efforts, yes. In addition to that, some of the synthetic fibers that we find so readily today will survive the elements even better than some of the natural ones. And so given the right conditions, I think we would see many textiles survive.
Yeah,
I
guess.
People have to want, like we have this in a museum collection, and 50 years ago, these wouldn't appear in a museum collection. They weren't valued enough. And they weren't recognized. But with the feminist movement, that these are women's arts, that has helped. Mm-hmm. With more indigenous rights, that has helped. Just the broadness of our knowledge that has been gained. But as a curator, I've directed our collecting in this way. And when I first started, which was 30 years ago at Emory, we only collected ancient things. But I felt that there are still native peoples that are creating and that we needed to keep up and to honor them as they need to be honored in the present.
Rebecca Stone, Renee Stein, this has been fascinating. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Emory Art History Professor Rebecca Stone is the curator of Threads of Time, Tradition and Change in Indigenous American Textiles. Renee Stein is the Carlos Museum's chief conservator. Threads of Time is on view at the Carlos Museum through December 17th. You've been listening to City Lights, a celebration of the arts and the ways in which we express ourselves creatively. Catch an encore broadcast tonight at 8. Tomorrow morning at 11, I'll talk with the new president and CEO of the National Black Arts Festival, Vicki Millender Morrow. City Lights is a production of WABE at Public Broadcasting Atlanta. Our producers are Aaron Wright, Gabby Watts, and Mike Johns. Our engineer is Kevin Rinker. I'm Lois Wrightsis. Follow me on Twitter. At Lois Wrightsis, that's spelled LOISREITZES. The station is at WABE News. That's all for today's edition of City Lights. Thanks for joining us and for listening to WABE Atlanta.